This is the Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley.
Look, we're going to shake things up.
On Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT.
I don't think we're asking the right question. I think the question we should be asking is, do you believe in this thing or not?
The Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley.
What do you mean? Of course martial arts training is relevant.
Now your hosts.
Let me save you some time. Get comfortable.
WSBT Radio's Sean Steyer.
Let's get started.
And former Irish quarterback, Evan Sharpley.
Stay sharp, my man. Stay sharp. We are ready to roll on this Friday. It's hockey weather outside once again after spring came. And, man, tell you what, things got frozen again real quick.
I hear it's supposed to be this way for a while, too.
Yeah.
A couple weeks.
It is February. That's what I keep telling my daughter. Why is it snowing again? It's February in South Bend. We could get snow into April, don't you know?
No doubt.
Buckle up. Speaking of hockey, Notre Dame hockey is at Penn State, where it's probably even colder than here right now. The puck drops at 6:30 tonight on Z94.3 FM with Darren Pritchett. And then they have a nice, accommodating getaway afternoon game tomorrow at 4 o'clock, also on Z94.3.
All right.
So Big Ten hockey continues. The Irish 10-1 on the road this year. They swept a couple games from Penn State earlier this season. Here at Notre Dame, Dmitry Smirnov, a nice Russian name, was not available for the Nittany Lions. You were just telling me, speaking of Russians, and the Olympics, the Winter Olympics are coming up here pretty soon. A big announcement from the IOC,
They overturned 28 Russians who were suspended for doping, and then they partially upheld 11 other appeals. And this was dating back to the Sochi Olympics, where there were over 43 that were banned for life. And this was back in 2014.
Any oligarchs part of this whole thing?
I don't know. I mean, it just looks so bad. How do you ban someone and then go back on it?
The Olympics coming up, especially.
Yes. I mean,
are you trying to crack down or not?
It's next week.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't know. I'm scratching my head on that one. And especially with how much information is available on what actually happened and, whether there was plausible deniability by some of the athletes, they still had to have known what was going on and what was being put in their bodies.
Were they suspected dopers or were they just because they had some kind of connection to that? The Icarus guy that you were telling me about before?
The entire program was tainted, in large part because of that. But, in the Sochi Olympics, they were doping during the Olympics. In the previous Olympics, they were doping up to a month before, and they had a process where they could get the blood or the urine clean. But with this specific Olympics in 2014, they were doping throughout the entire process. So in order to do that, they were actually tampering with breaking into areas that were supposed to be policed by the IOC, where they had, the B samples, the backup samples to do the additional testing if needed. And they were actually going in there, and through a special format, they were able to crack the seal without knowing it was cracked and put in the clean blood or the clean urine.
Netrudno.
And it was obviously
successful. It's not difficult, apparently,
to get past
them.
Now it's almost like you're wiping your hands clean and saying, well, they didn't really do it, when that's not the case.
Just seems odd that at this point.
Well, it's
are you
going to
put
like,
your foot down or not, right. IOC? Come on.
Yeah, one way or the other. Are you going to crack down and say we aren't going to allow this, or are we going to say, listen?
Yeah.
The Olympics are coming.
Let's have everyone do it.
Yeah.
We'll monitor it now, because in Icarus, in that documentary, the guy who was head of testing for 15 or 20 years, he says we're so far behind in trying to figure out what people are doing to cover things up, we have no chance. So, he admitted probably 90% of the athletes are doing or taking something or on some type of performance enhancing drug or who knows what it is. And I think we get on this topic every week is some sports look at it differently than others.
Right.
Is, how come in football versus baseball there it's a no-no? And in the Olympics, unless you're caught, everyone's like, man, these athletes are the best of the best.
Yep.
But they're going to be competing, apparently.
There's a long history, not just, remember the Irish swimmer, maybe you're too young, I think it was was either early 2000s, late 90s. She had never really done anything. And then all of a sudden she comes in, guns blazing, and she's winning all these gold medals out of nowhere.
Well, I think
it doesn't take too much to put two and two together.
In the last Summer Olympics with a Russian swimmer, that was when there was kind of like...
That's right, the stare down and all that stuff.
All that was going on. And in this article that I read, you know, it's that they're basically saying that clean sport is dead. It's done now.
Yeah, it's tough because the science is, I'm sure you're well aware, makes it that much easier for these guys who are into this, who are trying to beat the system, to stay ahead of the system and find the next thing. And that's why even right now, using baseball as an example, we talked about that with the Hall of Fame and all that last week. I think there are guys who are doing something right now, but they're ahead of the system because they have...
It's always that way.
Yeah.
You know, the guys that are developing... and you might have a background. I mean, the guys... And that was, you know, Bond's situation was he was partnered up with a guy who had experience in coming up with tests on how to find things. And if you know what people are looking for, and that's why, you know, the IOC, and that's why a lot of the testing commissions that do this, they don't allow just anybody to go in and know what the tests actually test for. Because if you know what the tests are testing for, you can get around those things. But if you have a guy who has a background in it, that can fool the system on, all right, it's not going to pick this, this, and this up, so we're going to go this route.
Which is that Icarus documentary that you told me about a while back that was on Netflix. It was a Russian guy who's right. tied to all these people who knew how to beat the system, and that's why they got away with it for as long as they did.
And, well, he's in witness protection now.
Yeah, now he's in hiding. I mean, he'll never...
And that's why when you watch the documentary, I couldn't believe, number one, how the documentary started was very fascinating to me, but then it was a complete twist on where it went. It started with a journalist who just wanted to blood dope to see if he could replicate what Lance Armstrong did.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a quarter
of
the
way... But he was also a competitive cyclist, not just a journalist.
Yeah, he was just an amateur cyclist, but he wanted to see if he could kind of take it to the next level.
Right.
But then next thing you know, like a quarter of the way through the documentary, he's linking up with this guy who has been...
Who's been busted. His lab in Moscow gets raided. Yeah.
And so then he's coming over to the U.S. they're working with him to try to get him, you know, in court to... But it got all shut down because it became really a global issue. And this guy was fearing for his life because his friends that were working in the lab back in Russia were getting killed and disappearing. So, and now everybody's competing.
If you have Netflix, search for Icarus, Icarus, I believe it is.
Yeah.
And I think it was nominated for an Academy Award. I think it's up for one, isn't it?
I believe
so. Did you see that? I believe it is in the documentary category. It's definitely interesting. The irony of that situation, this cyclist who went to this Russian who was trying to just doing an experiment to see, and he was obviously filming it and everything, so it was well documented. It's not like he was trying to get around it publicly anyway.
Yeah,
but the thing is, he actually regressed and did not get better, and so he was kind of mad about
that. Well, part of it too is he had a bike issue.
That was part of it. That's
broke
true.
Down. So he was frustrated about that. But in testing, his watt output, so how much power he was creating, like doubled. I think it went up. 20 or 25% over the course of him cycling through the testosterone. So he met with an anti-aging doctor to make sure that it was legal to get the testosterone and all the other... He was poking himself quite a bit.
But all these other cyclists were crushing him at the same time, not just his cycle. I mean, so that probably tells you that something else was going on too.
Well, that was what he said the previous year was. He finished 14th the year before.
Yeah.
And he goes, the top 10, he goes, I wasn't going to touch them. They were on another level. So that was where his mind kind of
was trying
like,
to go to that level.
Right, exactly. And, you know, when you look at the guys that are very successful, there's kind of another level that, especially in endurance sports like that, like, I mean, if you have fresh blood and there's oxygen in that blood, you're going to be able to go a lot further and a lot faster. And that was the case. So pretty interesting documentary.
Absolutely. He is Evan Sherpley. I'm Sean Stiers. Sean and Sherpley in the Leprechaun Lunch on Michiana Sports Leader 96.1 FM WSBT. Coming up on 10 minutes after 12 o'clock. We're brought to you by Sharply Training. With us, you can be a champion. Call today for a complimentary class, 574-226-8234. Visit sharplytraining.com. We'll get to some specifics on some things going on at Sharply Training in a little bit. We're also brought to you by Zolman's Tire and Auto Care, trusted community service for over 40 years, and by Lechleitner Door. When you need same-day service, Lechleitner Door delivers. Call 295-6311. It is Super Bowl weekend. Super Bowl 52 comes your way right here Sunday pregame.
I thought we had to call it the big game. That's all I ever hear.
We're allowed to say Super Bowl. It's in a commercial, yeah, that's big game. That's right. We're allowed to say it because we're, yeah, anyway. So Patriots, Eagles, we've got some specific stuff on the Super Bowl I want to get to in a little bit. I want to talk about some of this Notre Dame basketball news first, and then we've got a lot of Super Bowl stuff to get to. Maybe you didn't watch Jeopardy last night, or maybe you're not into social media and you haven't seen the disaster everywhere, but there was a football category last night and it went woefully wrong for all the geniuses, as Bill Parcells would say. And I want to get to that too, the 30 for 30 on Belichick and Parcells. Did you get to watch that at all last night?
I haven't watched it yet, no.
Okay, I watched it last night. So just a couple things that I wanted to kind of hit off that struck me. One thing in particular that really struck me, and I'm interested to see what you say about it. So, otherwise, though, Notre Dame women's basketball, they are cruising right now, man. Tell you what, 94-62.
You know, we talked about, from the men's side, you know, when you have as many injuries as you have, and Notre Dame women's basketball has had more than the men have,
right?
You try to latch onto something, and right now, I mean, they've come together, and they're playing really good basketball.
To be fair, they haven't lost their top two players like the men have at the same time. But the women are still cruising. They beat North Carolina 94-62. Marina Mabry, season high, 25 points, 8 assists last night. It was the 950th game in program history. But they have really come together, especially it seems like it was a circle the wagons kind of moment. They just got destroyed by Louisville, 100-67, back on January 11th, not quite a month ago. Since that game on national TV, they lose 100-67 to Louisville. They've won six straight games by an average score of 90-58.
It's a decent margin.
Yeah, not bad at all. And the closest game in that stretch was the 14-point win 2 weeks ago against Tennessee, mm-hmm. where they had to overcome the biggest deficit in program history to do it, 23 points. But then earlier this week, they beat Florida State, eighth-ranked Florida State, in Tallahassee, 100-69. So they've found another level to go to right now. Very impressive.
And you're peaking at the right time of the season, too. I mean, yep. You want to get hot now and hopefully carry that into the postseason.
Yep, absolutely. And I think maybe as impressive as anything, not just the scoring, is what they're doing defensively. Again, they're holding those six opponents mm-hmm. to 58 points, and some of them, like Florida State, are ranked.
Yeah, no doubt.
Going to another level. But the other side of this now...
Maybe the men can latch on and grab some
too.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I mean, what is still impressive about the men is, even though they haven't been able to turn it into victories, yeah, they're playing right down to the end. And I know Darren doesn't like to talk about effort, but I think effort is still important because not everyone gives consistent mm-hmm. effort, whether you're Division One
or
not.
It's better than cashing out early. It is.
Look at Duke. They have all these five-star guys out there, and a lot of them had no interest in playing defense. So I think if we can knock those guys for not playing defense and not showing effort, we can praise a team that, even though they're not winning, is still giving effort all the way through.
I still am with Darren on it's a win or loss. I mean, it's about the wins. I mean, you want the guys playing.
Are you patting
hard.
Them on the back? Are you giving them a ribbon and all that kind of stuff? And I understand that, but it has to start with effort consistently.
At this point of the season, too, I mean, when you're on a losing skid like this and you're struggling, that's something that you can coach off of. Guys, we're still playing hard. We're in these games. We're going to turn the corner. Those are things, as a coaching staff that you can continue to focus on, because there's not a lot of positives if you are losing.
Right. And that's exactly it. And so Mike
and
Bray.
Not, and they're not getting a lot of great information here, too, with, I mean, with the guys that have been...
No, and that's the thing. It's like they keep getting close, and then... So DJ Harvey, here's the news. Mike Bray met with the media yesterday before practice yesterday, and we're kind of hoping to hear, because he alluded after the Duke game, maybe we're going to get some guys back, plural guys,
right,
for this next
thinking
game.
Thinking Farrell and Harvey, yeah.
Right, thinking Farrell and Harvey. Well, DJ Harvey is definitely out at least the next two games. That means tomorrow at North Carolina State and next Tuesday against Boston College. Maybe he gets back a week from tomorrow against Florida State. So,
a week out.
Got to wait a little bit longer, but yeah. And then the Matt Farrell practiced lightly yesterday. Excuse me, once they get, I don't know if it's before they leave town today or once they get out there for their shoot-around at NC State, he'll go a little bit harder today, and he's going to be a game-time decision tomorrow. Now, Tom Noy on Sports Beat yesterday said he's got to play. So, even and he's like he said, even if they get 18 minutes. So, here's Mike Bray kind of with the health status of Matt Farrell right now.
Yeah, he's been shooting a little bit. We didn't really go live with him today. He's going to try it, probably not the whole practice, but been out shooting on his own. His lift looks better. You know, he wasn't able to lift, you know, when he came back the first time. But we'll see how it reacts to a half a practice today, maybe a whole practice tomorrow, and cut him loose Saturday and start him if he's feeling good.
Are you feeling good about it? Do you feel like there's a good chance to get him?
I'd have to evaluate him really the next 2 days live. I haven't seen him go 5-on-5 yet and then see how he feels. We could use that lift of having him in the lineup, even if it's for 18 minutes, you know, just to have him in the game some. That could really help us and lift us, so I'm hopeful we can get there.
Farrell, of course, scored 23 when he came back against Louisville. About 15 of it came in like the first 7-8 minutes, something like that. And then he just was not able to stay on track after that. I think he got a big shot of adrenaline and just came out of the gates full guns blazing.
And maybe that's, you know, if he does play, that's kind of how you play it, is, you know, short bursts of energy and try to capitalize. I mean, he's a high effort guy on the court, and he you know, he's a facilitator and makes things happen. And if it's 3 to 5 minute stretches, you know, over the course of the game for, you know, whether it's 3 or 4 different bursts of energy like that, maybe that's the best way to play it. And, you know, certainly see how his ankle feels game time too.
If nothing else, with the lack of offense that they've had, they've been really inconsistent scoring. If nothing else, it gives you another score.
Right.
And it gives you more depth. Like you said, even if it's in 3 or 4 minute spurts, like start of the
just
game
like
to the
Notre
first
Dame
media
hockey.
Timeout,
let's
you sit
let's
out.
Let's go yeah. line changes.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, and you couldn't do a full line change, but you could at least go 3
right
now. But it's got to make up for the fact that you've got 3 guys who are combining to average about 7.5 points among the 7 healthy guys they've got right now. So if you've got a guy like Farrell who's averaging 15.5, that's going to help you. Here's what Farrell said. He sat out the last cut. He played against, as I said, Louisville and then Clemson, scored just 5 points in that loss at Clemson, and then sat out Virginia Tech and Duke. And he was asked yesterday before the practice how he feels now compared to when he was trying to come back for that Louisville game.
I don't know. I kind of feel the same. You know, I got to get back as soon as I can. You know, I'm trying to help the team, and I'm trying to get on the floor and play with these guys. So it's sort of the same thing, but just being more careful now and making sure that I'm 100% before I come back so I can keep playing the rest of the year and not have this lingering around.
And again, they're in a situation where, as Mike Bray said, they're getting to the back 9 of the conference schedule now. They went 3-6 in the first 9. There are games out there to be won, but quite frankly, there have been games, really all but the Duke game, I think you could say, they had a competitive chance of winning during the 6-game losing streak.
Yeah, I mean, it's crunch time now. I mean, they got to start winning some games if they want to make a run here towards the end of the season. You know, their saving grace is they're playing in a very difficult conference. So if they can make a run, they can get a couple of quality wins. You've got North Carolina. You still have Virginia on the schedule, too. I mean, that's going to go a long way if they're able to peak towards the end of this conference schedule and maybe get a couple of guys back healthy.
Now, this is a long way away, and I didn't get to pose this to Tom Noy. He was with me in the second hour of Sports Beat last night. I'll get a chance at some point. Here's what I started thinking about kind of when, after he left last night and we wrapped up the show. What happens, say they win 3-4 games here of the remaining nine games in the regular season. So let's say it's 4. That puts you at 7-9. So you go into the ACC tournament. You're the 12, 13, 11 seed, whatever it happens to be, right? So let's say you're without Bonzi Colson for all the regular season, but now Bonzi comes back, like Mike Bray has been hoping, for the ACC tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you make a run to the ACC championship game, but you lose. Okay? So you went sub-500 during the regular season in ACC play, but now you're at full strength. What does the committee do with that Notre Dame team, knowing that, okay, even though they didn't get the automatic bid, they were without their two best players for the bulk of this, including Bonzi, who's averages a double-double. What do you do with Notre Dame? Do you think that they could get some consideration?
Well, I think if you're assuming that they do make a run and play in the championship game, you would think then that Colson played well.
Right.
So I would say if I'm a committee member and I look at them, their value is the highest it's been all season or since early in the season when they were playing really well with Farrell and Colson. They're going to make a strong argument if they make a run in that tournament because they're going to be playing against some good teams. I think it would be difficult to keep them out if that was the case.
Because this is what they're capable of.
Correct.
When they're at full strength. And that's so now, even though their overall resume isn't going to look real glossy or anything, they were without their best player, their double-double, their preseason national mm-hmm. player of the year candidate, Bonzi Colson, for 2 months. They get Matt Farrell back here and there, and now they've got full strength and they get to the at least get
would,
to the
I
ACC
think you'd
championship.
Have to at least consider it and take
I think
that
so.
I mean take that into
you know, I think they when, make when it really hard if nothing else.
Exactly. Really hard. I mean I think that would one that you'd really debate on. We saw what they could do with those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then if that's how they finish the season too at full strength, no doubt. I think they'd be in the discussion.
I think so, too. One final thought on Matt Farrell potentially coming back tomorrow. And again, he's going to be a game-time decision tomorrow. No Bonzi. He's going to get another X-ray on his foot on Monday. No DJ Harvey. He's going to be out at least the next two. Maybe he's back a week from tomorrow against Florida State. So with Farrell coming back, TJ Gibbs has been on fire with Farrell out. He had 22 points Monday against Duke, career-high 27 the game before that. So What's the combination? How do you keep Gibbs going once Farrell does come back? And here's Mike Bray's answer to that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, it's one of the things I've really thought about a lot. And, you know, one of the things I think we would do Saturday is let Gibbs start with the ball in his hands and have Matty off the ball and just let him get comfortable. And even from a conditioning standpoint. And then, you know, once we substitute, you know, bring Matty back to the ball, but at least start the game with Gibbs with it in his hands. I think that could help him, kind of jumpstart himself because he's been so darn good with it. Of course, you know, we get a rebound. Either guy can bring it up. And then I don't want to overanalyze it too much because, you know, they both play off of each other pretty well. But maybe we start the game that way and it helps both of them given their situations.
I like that.
Well said.
Yeah, like it. Well, he's the coach, so
it's great. I mean, it's a great idea.
Yeah, you don't put as much on Matt Farrell. You make him more a scorer because that's what they need right now. They don't necessarily need his ability as a point guard facilitator. They need him to score. They need Gibbs to keep scoring too. But I think it makes a lot of sense. And then he's going to sub out, and
it'll be
maybe
less force
Fluger's
on his
running
ankle
it a little
too.
More, like yeah. he's done. Yeah. So
I think it's the right way to play it.
Yeah. Definitely, it's a good combo. One thing that I wanted to ask you, Evan, before we kind of continue, we'll get to some Super Bowl thoughts and the 30 for 30 on Belichick and Parcells. You were a two-sport athlete at Notre Dame, baseball and football. You've talked about how you left as your school's all-time leading three-point shooter.
Correct. Yeah.
In high school,
tied now.
Yeah.
Somebody tied me.
So I'm curious, and I kind of made this joke on Twitter last week, and Tom Noy was like, oh, come on. But Rex Fluger got hurt, of course, in the Virginia Tech game. He had to leave for a little bit, and when he leaves, they're down to 6 scholarship players out there. And I made the joke, well, if Phil Dracovic, the guy who's
the big quarterback recruit who's coming in next year. If he had enrolled early, he might be next up right now, because there's so little depth that Mike Bray obviously has. And it's not, it's, there have been plenty of basketball programs. Even Mike Bray has done it in the past. You pull a guy from the football team who's got some experience. Who are some guys you played with that might have made some good basketball players? Well,
each year we had quite a few guys that would play bookstore basketball the tournament on campus. I tried to. It was usually difficult because I was playing baseball at the time. But we had some pretty good. There were some pretty good teams put together by football players. Kyle Rudolph was one guy that came to mind. Robbie Paris could really shoot it. He was a really good high school basketball player too. And before his hip injury, he dislocated and broke his hip in high school. He could jump really well too, jump and shoot. And then Sergio Brown was another guy, could really create, and then, man, could he elevate.
And then, of course, you, right?
Yeah.
Because of your three-point shooting ability.
Well, no doubt. I mean, if I was on the right team, I mean, I just would float around, you know, the three-point line and you know, set some screens and roll and get lost in transition. That was my game. And then pick a pocket here and there and, you know, get it to the guys that were controlling the ball. But I did a pretty good job of getting lost and finding the open shot.
But
we had some some talented guys. We had a lot of guys that were, you know, two or three sport athletes, and either going to playing at the rec center right across from the Goog. My dorm was closer to the Rock, the Rockne Heritage Center. So I usually played most of my games there.
Okay,
I'd go there and work out, and then the gym is on the second floor, so I'd go up there and, you know, run with a team or so and play for an hour or two, and that was a lot of fun.
The football coaches ever, it was, like, discourage you guys from playing?
It
because
was a
of,
conversation of, you know, don't be stupid. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, the bookstore, how it's set up. I mean, you can run into some teams that maybe have a little too much fun before they show up, and it could be, you know, dangerous, or, you know, someone looking to make a play against a guy who's on a, you know, on the football team or on the baseball team, things like that. But it usually wasn't like that. I think the only time where, you know, as a player you felt in danger was if it rained, and you're playing out there, you know. Yeah, it was. So, you know, but I'll tell you what, too, the games got pretty physical, and especially once you got into the, you know, the Final Four and then the championship game, it was there were no easy points. And shooting outside is different than shooting inside, and that's why, you know, for me, if you got a little bit of wind, and those rims over there, they're tight, too.
Are they?
Yeah, I mean, the teams that had the most success were guys that either could create and get to the rack or had a big that was pretty skilled down low. And normally those were guys that were scholarship players.
Yeah.
on another team outside of the basketball team,
right.
They were pretty good.
Right, exactly. Okay, 12:28. We're going to get to some Super Bowl stuff coming up next, including we've got some of the prop bets from for the Super Bowl that we're going to address here in a little bit. We're also going to talk a little bit about last night's ESPN 30 for 30, the two Bills, Bill Belichick, Bill Parcells. And also, Justin Timberlake made an interesting statement yesterday. He's going to be performing at halftime of the Super Bowl, and he said he wouldn't let his son play football. So I'm going to get Evan's take on that as a former football player, what he would do. He has a daughter, but what he would do if and when he has a son, would he let him play football? We'll do all that when we return. Sean and Sharpley, Leprechaun Lunch, Michiana Sports Leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT. On this frigid Friday afternoon, Sean and Sharpley in the Leprechaun Lunch. Hopefully we'll keep you warm for another 30 minutes or so. Don't forget Budweiser's weekday sports beat comes your way tonight, 5 to 7 on WSBT. Darren Pritchett, who's on the road with Notre Dame hockey at Penn State, has the first hour of the show with Eric Hansen. And Tyler James from the South Bend Tribune will be with me. We had a recruiting update yesterday with Tyler, and we'll talk a little bit more recruiting and some other stuff in the 6 to 7 o'clock hour tonight on Budweiser's weekday sports feed. I wanted to mention a couple of things, Evan, about baseball. And originally, they were going to institute a 20-second pitch clock. Apparently, they've decided they're not going to do that. But two notable things. One really notable thing, all major league ballparks are going to have netting to the ends of each dugout.
Fantastic.
Finally. I really don't understand what took
net
them so long
place.
To do it. That's right. Just put netting everywhere.
You'll know if it's a home run. It'll hit the net.
That's right. And broken bats are the biggest thing. Yeah. Baseball's come flying in there, too, but broken bats are the biggest thing. And I've never understood, because if you sit behind a home plate, I mean, you've got great seats. You're looking through a net there, so I've never understood why extending it to the end of the dugouts is such a big deal.
And that's where most of the bats and balls go anyway.
Right, right. Exactly. The other thing, again, they're trying to speed up games. There's not going to be a pitch clock this year. The players' union didn't want it. I think they need to, and I know they've tried it in...
I think 20 would have been, I don't know.
20 seems way too, like maybe they should start off with at least 30 or something, yeah. Work their way to 20 at some point, but they're not going to do it. But apparently, they're going to bring bullpen carts back. Have you heard this?
Oh, yes.
If you've ever seen it, bullpen carts were sweet, man. It's basically a golf cart, and the ones in the 70s anyway, they had like the big oversized yeah. hats of the team
so
on top
like
of
no
them.
So now like no more John Rocker sprinting from the outfield.
Yeah.
Or guys walking.
That's right. Instead, they're going to drive them in.
All right.
Which, I don't know exactly how much time that'll save, but at the same time, it's pretty cool. You'll have a guy who'll chauffeur the relievers. From the pen to the mound.
I agree. Something's got to be done to shorten the games. I don't know where you go with it, how it happens, but 4-hour games are too long.
I think it's a bigger deal because of the postseason. And part of the problem with the postseason is, one, you're starting games later in general.
Right.
And two, you've got more commercial inventory because they're bigger games and these networks, Fox, TBS, whoever's doing them, are trying to get their money. So they're loading them. Same thing happens with the College World Series. They have the longest games of the year because ESPN's trying to get mm-hmm. their money. They're loading those things up, all the breaks with commercials. So
there's the Detroit Catholic League baseball, they start counts with, or each at bat you would walk in, and I believe it was a two ball, one strike count.
In extra innings?
No. The whole year.
In general, wow.
Yeah, just in the league. Out of league,
don't like
different,
that at all.
But it was 2-1. So you're stepping in, and as a pitcher, you gotta throw two strikes.
No.
So you know, as a hitter, man, I got to get after it.
See, and I thought, the other thing that they're talking about, they're not going to do it this year, it doesn't sound like, but they're talking about the Little League and the tournament extra innings rule, where you get to extra innings, you start with a runner at second base.
Ooh.
To try to speed up scoring.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So
I would consider that one.
Again, I think there's more kickback because of these long extra inning games. You get
right.
a couple 15, 16 inning games that go 4.5, 5 hours, and oh, the world is ending. Baseball lasts too long. Well,
yeah.
that's still the exception and not the rule.
Sure.
So
sure.
I don't know that we need to quite overreact that far, but. I don't know. But it's an interesting idea. I during the regular season, maybe I could see it more, mm-hmm. but postseason.
No, postseason.
I don't think you should be doing it in postseason.
Yeah. Maybe during the regular season.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to play
save
a 16
some
or 17 inning game, and then you're back at it the next day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that happening.
All right. It is 12:37. Two Bills last night, ESPN 30 for 30. You didn't see it. And real quick, the two Bills are Bill Belichick, Bill Parcells, and it just chronicles the relationship that they had. Parcells and Belichick actually got to the Giants together early 80s. They were assistants under Ray Perkins. Perkins gets canned. Parcells ends up being the head coach. Belichick is his defensive coordinator. They win a couple Super Bowls together, including shutting down Jim Kelly's K-gun offense. In, I guess it was 1991, in that Super Bowl, the first of the four falls for the Buffalo Bills. But obviously, Belichick goes on, does his own thing. The icy relationship started when Parcells had been the Patriots head coach. He leaves, goes to the Jets. Belichick comes with him after he had been fired by the Browns. Mm-hmm. Belichick had rejoined Parcells in New England. So they go to the Jets together. And the contract there stipulated that if Parcells ever stepped down, Belichick was going to become the head coach of the Jets. Well, what had happened, Robert Kraft in New England had fired Pete Carroll. And so now he's looking for a head coach. He faxes over a letter to the Jets saying, hey, I'd like to interview Belichick. Well, that letter gets to Parcells, and they don't tell Belichick. And then Belichick ends up finding out about it. And so you can understand why.
See you later.
Yeah, that's right. And so Belichick, before ever coaching a game, he was basically head coach of the Jets twice without ever coaching a game, because he holds this press conference saying, no, I'm not going to be the Jets head coach. About 30 days later, he ends up getting hired by New England. The dynasty starts and the whole thing. So the most interesting part to me, they're really, even back in the day when they were succeeding together, they weren't the closest friends. They were friendly, but not great friends. They were at least social. But the most compelling part of the whole thing is toward the end, they're sitting at a table together, and the guy doing the 30 for 30, who's asking all the questions, he asks them if they love each other. And they're basically sitting there like cavemen, trying not to look at each other, and neither one of them would come out and say it. And so I'm just, while they're sitting there completely stone-faced, like, obviously, again, trying not to make eye contact with each other and trying not to make any expression, I'm waiting for this song to start.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt.
It never happened, though. You know, you want him to kind of go out head bobbing or whatever, but
Night at the Roxbury.
Yeah,
style.
That's right. So that never happened, and they never said they loved each other. Which
did they even say anything? Stumble over some words?
They did not. They just they might have said something. I don't know, but it was definitely the most awkward moment of the whole thing. They ended up leaving the interview room, and they. They go out, and they were walking around Giant Stadium and the whole thing, and they were reminiscing. It's the new one. It's not where they actually won it all together, but they had kind of a bust of Parcells, and Parcells is, you know, like telling Belichick, hey, you know, you're going to get one of these, and Belichick's just kind of standing there not really acknowledging. It's like, of course I'm going to get one of those. One more Super Bowls than you. What are you talking about? But so it was definitely interesting. But again, that was the most awkward point of the whole thing.
And it seems, you know, publicly pretty different personalities, too. I mean,
yeah.
And I think from a coaching standpoint as well, there are some similarities as far as, you know, what they expect from the guys on their team. But I think the way they approach how they interact with the players, very, very different.
Yeah.
Different.
Well, and even back in the day, Belichick, in the interviews that they had with it, just his personality was a lot different. Not that he was overflowing bubbly, but he had at least more personality talking to the media and those kind of things and the opportunities
versus
that he
when
had.
They ask him what's different about this Super Bowl. And he
just said, yeah, that's right.
Minnesota.
Well, you know, and I think the part about Parcells is especially now, because like they covered how Belichick's defense in their run to that Super Bowl against the Bills, which was their second Super Bowl win together, they shut down the 49ers. I think the Bears were in that run as well. And they gave completely different defensive looks to each one of those opponents and just the way that Belichick went about the game plan, which is really the basis of what he is right now. When you hear about he's going to take away what you do best on each side of the ball, that's really the basis for it. So I think there's some of that, and they did mention it, where like the innuendo that Parcells couldn't have won those Super Bowls
without
Belichick, and I think he feels some of that. You know, there's kind of some of that pull back and forth. But I mean, Belichick is what he is, and five Super Bowls and maybe a sixth one later.
He's pretty good.
Yep. Super Bowl 52 coming up Sunday. 2 o'clock is when the pregame coverage begins. That's 4.5 hours of pregame coverage leading up to kickoff here on WSBT.
All right.
Now, in the meantime, Justin Timberlake He's going to be performing at halftime of the Super Bowl.
My wife and I saw him perform in person.
Did you?
Yeah. He's talented.
So you'd give it an A?
I was a little on the fence about going to a Justin Timberlake concert. And then I went
as a guy, I think we probably
all
would.
And I watched him. I mean, he's like the total package as a performer. You know, he can sing, he can dance, he plays like multiple instruments.
Yeah.
If I were to be a performer, I feel like I would want to be like him.
I enjoy when he goes on Saturday Night Live and he does some of the skits.
Too.
There was the infamous in a box one. But the other one that I like the most is, I think it shows up on the Christmas shows when he shows up, bring it on down to Liquor Town. That's good stuff. But so he got his own press conference yesterday, and he was asked here's the question he was asked.
So you would support if he wanted to run some routes and get in the NFL?
He will never play football.
Okay.
No. I mean, yeah, it's kind of like that thing where my main objective is that he become a great person. If he wants to get into the arts or sports, then yeah, I mean, I would fully support that.
Now, I should have set that up a little better. He's talking about his son. He was asked if he would let his son play football, essentially, and he said no, that he wouldn't. I'm a little conflicted with that specifically, because why can't your son play football and be a good person and do all those right. other things as well? You played football. I think that you turned out pretty well. It's not like one conflicts mm-hmm. with the other, but as someone who played football at Notre Dame and the whole thing, what do you think about this right now? Because it is a big issue, especially directly related to the concussion stuff.
Yeah, it's a very hot topic right now. And I think you know, for families that are considering, you know, playing tackle football, and there's been some legislation in some states of discussing, well, we're going to hold off on tackle football until, you know, 12 or 13. You know, what is the age? I think the conversation with that is just trying to save hits on the head.
Yeah.
Not that, you know, when you're 12, 13, 14, hits to the head are still dangerous, but to maybe eliminate those hits if you're starting tackle football at 9, 10. The first year I played was third grade, and before that, you know, played soccer. But third, fourth, I mean, I was in tackle football up until I was 21 years old. So, you know, for me, I think the advice I would give, it's going to be one of those conversations that you have as a family. It might not make sense for some. And I've listened to a couple of interviews from guys that are in the NFL and guys that had previously played, Brian Urlacher being one. And he admitted, he goes, you know, if you're making that decision, you are basically telling your son that's playing, you're playing a violent sport. You are going to potentially be in a position where you could get hurt. It's not just head injuries. It could be other extremities. It could be, you know, a broken bone. But, you know, the hot topic is the CTE, is the head trauma. So I think it's twofold. I mean, if you get rid of and say they're not going to play tackle football till 12 or 13, it still comes down to how you tackle and what you're using your head for. So I think if it's taught the correct way, you're not having as many of these conversations. Now, when you turn on the NFL and you watch games, I mean, it's the big hits that people, I mean, when I go to, say, like a UFC fight, no one wants to see a guy grapple for 20 right. minutes. You want to see the guy knocked out. That's why people go to those types of events. Now, that's not healthy for the person in there, but you're not there. So, and that's why I think that it's the conversation that you would have as a family on, you know, does this make sense? Are we weighing the risks and rewards here? You know, is the game getting safer? And I think, you know, right now, because it's at the forefront of everyone's minds, there certainly is an active, in a positive sense, in how can we make the game more safe?
Right.
And I think that path is very, very positive.
Yeah, and again, I think I said this earlier. I didn't mention it just now. You have a young daughter. You don't have a son yet, but you have at least one brother right?
Yes.
Did he play football as well?
He played football in high school, didn't play as a senior, and then actually walked down the Notre
Dame
football
team as a senior.
That's right,
he did. I forgot about that. He was a pitcher at Notre Dame for a while.
Yeah, and then walked down as a senior. So he played. He has a son who's 5 years old. We haven't really, you know, breached that subject yet. I don't 100% know what, you know, what his thoughts are on that. And like I said, I mean, I think it's gonna vary. The one thing I am seeing, though, in this area and really across the nation too, is numbers are down in the middle schools with tackle football. You're seeing numbers in lacrosse go up, which strangely enough is still a contact sport, and there's mm-hmm. still concussions in soccer.
That's right.
You know, it's not that those numbers are any different, but I think just the blunt trauma, because you have a helmet on and you're wearing pads, the stigma is a little bit different. Not to say, you know, one is worse than the other, but you know, a lot of they're contact sports.
I have a son who is finishing college now. He played Pop Warner, played in high school, and then played at the NAIA level in football. Played middle linebacker the whole way. And I was conflicted about it mm-hmm. every step of the way, really starting toward the end of the Pop Warner. And here's why. Because as I look back now, again, he played middle linebacker the whole time, so there's a lot of contact there. And there was a game where I didn't think about it at the time for whatever reason, even though I've been around football, played myself when I was younger. He probably had a concussion when I look back and, you know, really after looking at some of the symptoms and things like that. He got into high school, had at least one concussion in high school. There was a game his sophomore year where he played at Adams. They were playing Clay, and this was the last year. I think LaFonso Ellis' son played tackle for that. Offensive tackle for that Clay team. It was Joe Shiko toward the end for him when they were one of their last pretty good teams. But he didn't find this out till after the fact, but suffered a concussion, basically didn't remember the whole second half. And then at that point, you're going, oh, my God, what have I done? What am I letting him do? So there's always been that conflict in me. At the same time, he was always a pretty good form tackler. At just what you were talking about, there was a lot more form. He was never deliver the big demonstrative blows. And depending on who you have as your coach, that's either a positive or a negative because those things stand out on tape and film more. And coaches tend to want to see those bigger blows. But he was coached well. But then I go back a couple of different things. One, I think it has to be because it became a point of emphasis in high school at that time when he was in high school where referees were supposed to be calling the helmet-to-helmet stuff more.
Right.
I did not see it called. There were specific, boom, helmet-to-helmet stuff, and you're not seeing the flags thrown. Again, at the lower levels, I think that's where it has to start in the Pop Warner, Midget, Rocket, whatever it happens to be called. They need to... They need to go overboard calling the helmet-to-helmet stuff. Otherwise, you're never going to deter the kids from doing it. Now, specific to my own experience, I grew up in a town from second to seventh grade playing flag football. And the high school in that town was a state power. And this was in Kansas, Manhattan, Kansas, where Kansas State University is. They were winning state championships, going to the state playoffs all the time. So from... Their youth program was flag football. You couldn't play tackle football until you were eighth grade. They were really good. Their high school was really good, despite the fact that you grew up playing flag football. Mm-hmm. I moved to another town from the eighth grade and then finished high school where they had a Pop Warner program, and neither of the high schools in that town were any good. So I realize that's a small sample size, but I don't believe that you have to grow up playing tackle football to be a good tackle football player once you're in middle school and high school and beyond. So that's kind of my personal experience with it.
Do we need to set up a bigger sample size then and try it out?
Maybe so. I think you can still learn a lot of fundamentals, starting with teamwork, mm-hmm. how to play football. You still rush the passer. You still block. You still do all those things. You're doing everything but tackle, basically, when you're playing flag football, and you're avoiding a lot of those
big hits that we were.
What do the
linemen
do? I think, and that was one thing with the flag. Is there something comparable for?
Well, this was full 11-on-11. This is not like
full 11-on-11.
Yeah, this is not like the 8-on-8 or 7-on-7 where you know guards are eligible for passes and all that. It was complete football rules where you had a full. You had a center, two guards, two tackles.
That's interesting.
The whole thing.
You don't hear that very often. It's more of the one center snaps it.
Right.
And you've got, you know, four or five receivers or a running back in there. So,
yeah. So it was the whole thing, everything except tackling that you did. So it was just, it was your regular game of football. Mm-hmm. It was just that you had flags on instead of tackling guys. So, with everything that I've experienced, I don't think that you have to grow up playing tackle football to be a good tackle football player in high school. I mean, in concussions, we talk about big hits and things like that. We're starting to run behind a little bit here. But Brian Roberts, the Baltimore Orioles second baseman a few years back, he suffered a concussion just sliding headfirst into second base. Mm-hmm. And then it took him a couple years before he could get completely back just because the running jostled his brain enough. So it's not just big, loud, demonstrative hits that you can suffer a concussion from and have problems down the line. So I think there's a lot of things that can still be looked at. And I would advocate the flag football programs for sure. Because again, I think there's a lot that can still be learned from that. All right, we've got to get into this break because, again, we're way behind now. Sean and Sharpley, WSBT. We are winding down Sean and Sharpley and the Leprechaun Lunch. We're brought to you by Zolman's Tire and Auto Care, trusted community service for over 40 years. Lechleitner Door, 295-6311 is the number to call, and Sharpley Training as well. Visit sharpleytraining.com. Didn't get a chance to mention a big trip you've got coming up, but we'll do that next week, all right?
Italy.
Coming up. When is that?
March. End of March, early April.
Che bella. That's all I know. All right. We have the Rich Eisen Show coming up. Don't forget, coming up tonight, Budweiser's weekday sports beat comes your way from 5 to 7 like it does every weeknight here on WSBT. And Evan and I will be back next week. Super Bowl pick?
Don't bet against Tom Brady.
I have to think you're right. That is coming up again. Coverage starts at 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon. Super Bowl 52. Right here on Michiana Sports Leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT South Bend. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Talk to you next week.